All right, nice to have everyone back with us as we celebrate the weekend of 42, and that is the life and legacy of the great Jackie Robinson. Fans, it's always a pleasure for me to bring to you another wonderful book about baseball and specifically about Jackie Robinson. It's called 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. It's edited by Michael G. Long, a tremendous baseball fan, and he's written about baseball in the past. And he has again created a book of essays which take you through the life of Jackie Robinson. Michael, a pleasure to have you with us this morning. How are you?
Hey, Marty. It's great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. And again, the book is 42 Today, and some of the leading writers and baseball historians in the country have contributed essays about the life of Jackie Robinson as he grew up, his time in baseball, after baseball, his political career, and just who the man was and is in today's world. And you've put that together. How did this project come together for you?
It came together primarily because I was a little upset and still am that we freed Robinson in 1947, the year that he shattered the color barrier in Major League Baseball. He's so safe and non-threatening. He's non-violent at that time. He's turning the other cheek. And I wanted us to get past that Robinson, not to ignore it and to embrace that part of Robinson, but also to dig deeper, to see him as a multidimensional figure, as somebody who was more than the smiling second baseman in 1947, somebody who had a fiery temper. So it really started with my thought of digging deeper into Robinson's life and legacy.
Michael, how did you do that? And maybe you could take us through a few of those essays that touch upon what you just talked about.
Sure. I'll point to Jonathan Ive's essay on number 42 in the book. When Robinson arrived at the Brooklyn Dodgers locker room, there was no locker for him. His jersey was on a peg, and it was the number 42, which was a high number at that point. It was not a number that players aspire to. High numbers are pretty common today, but at that point, they were not. Number 4 was available in 1947. Number 2 was available in 1947. But Robinson got number 42. The Dodgers weren't quite sure that great experiment was going to work. And Robinson cut a lonely and lonesome figure in that year. Turning the other cheek did not come naturally to him. But, you know, he made a number out of 42. We didn't know it before 47. We sure as heck know it today. He did a great job turning the other cheek again. He was not naturally nonviolent. He was inclined to strike back. He had that temper like a rattlesnake, as one of his Negro Leagues colleagues put it. But Robinson swallowed all those racist insults in 47 and turned them into muscle and became the Rookie of the Year in that first year.
One thing in that essay by Jonathan Eig, E-I-G, he talks a lot about meeting Rachel Robinson. And Rachel really, really let loose and let Jonathan know really what Jackie went through in those early days. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, I love Rachel Robinson for her honesty and brutal honesty at times. And she lets us know that the myth surrounding Pee Wee Reese walking over to Jack Robinson and putting his arm around him in 1947 never happened. And we puncture that myth in the book. Jonathan Eig punctures that myth in the book. And it's part of this desire that we have in white America to make ourselves think that we really paved the way for Jack Robinson. Well, Rachel says that his teammates simply weren't around him early in 1947. She says that he came home late at night from the ballpark, and he went into the apartment, and he went into the bedroom and got on his knees and prayed to God for strength and determination and courage. He cut a lonely figure. Now, the players did start to surround him and celebrate him when they realized that he made the turnstiles click, and when that they realized that he could help them win the pennant and then the World Series. When they realized that he could help them succeed, then they rallied around him, but not until that point.
Well, Michael Long is with us. The book is 42 Today, a number of essays along the lines of what Michael has just talked about. One is by Howard Bryant. Of course, we love Howard, an ESPN senior writer. Howard's been on with us many times and talked about ownership, how Jackie Robinson thought that ownership, that if you're breathing, you're entitled to live like a man, as opposed to just advancement. How did Jackie deal with that conflict?
Let me tell you that that is rooted partly in a lesson that Mally, his mother, taught him. early on in his life, Mally taught him that Adam and Eve's story. She said that Adam and Eve were originally black, Jackie, but then they were scared white when God caught Eve eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So she took that spiritual lesson, Marty, and she still instilled within him this sense that the color of his skin was full of dignity. Robinson took that lesson, and he believed that the rights that he fought for were already his just by his birthright and by his God-ordained status as a human being. Robinson claimed ownership. Now, the rest of America, as Howard Bryant points out in his brilliant essay, wanted advancement, and that is a gradual drift toward first-class citizenship for black Americans. Robinson suffered no fools greatly, and he was really upset in the late 40s and 50s with Ike Eisenhower, who insisted on a moderate approach to civil rights. Robinson did not embrace moderation at any point in his career, except in 47 and 48 when he decided to turn the other cheek.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at Jackie from 47 on, maybe till Frank Robinson got there to some degree, the African-American players who were in the big leagues sort of were quiet, and they played baseball. They were baseball players. Jackie was much more than that, and that comes across, too, in the essays.
Yeah, Robinson was outspoken. Though I have to tell you, Marty, when he looked back on his baseball career, he expressed some regret at not having stood up for civil rights more than he had, at not having spoken out as much as he could have. And indeed, after baseball, he criticized a lot of his fellow black athletes for not standing up for civil rights as forcefully as they could have, including, by the way, Frank Robinson. He folded Robinson for going after a management position while sacrificing the ability to speak out about civil rights. Robinson himself was no Michael Jordan after baseball. He really used his bully pulpit. You know, he was sort of like Oprah in terms of his popularity. He used his bully pulpit really to advance civil rights as vocally as he could.
How did the white media treat him in the 40s, in the late 40s? His debut in April 15th, of course, which we celebrate each year, April 15th, 1947. How did the white media treat Jackie Robinson? We know the black media, very adamant in the 30s and early 40s about integration. The communists, the Daily Worker with Lester Rodney, who our dear friend we've had on the show years ago, was the leading white writer to integrate baseball. But what about the group of white media? How did they treat Jackie?
Wow, that's awesome. You had Lester Rodney on. That's terrific, Marty. The white media, let me just give you a little glimpse through Chris Lamb's essay. The white media in 1946 had a reception in New York City. This would have been the sports writers, the New York sports writers. They put on a skit. It was a blackface skit. And a white person depicted Jackie Robinson as a submissive butler in a southern plantation who was serving a white southern aristocrat. You know, the white media, much of the white media, I don't want to say all, but much of the white media really was part of the racist system that kept Robinson out of Major League Baseball. So when they reported about Robinson's debut in 1947, they did not include the Jim Crow context that had prevented Robinson from entering Major League Baseball exactly because they were part of that context. They had created part of the Jim Crow system that kept Robinson out. Nor did they report on the promise that Robinson gave so many black Americans when he debuted with the Dodgers in 1947, because they weren't simply part of that culture and didn't understand everything that April 15th meant to black America. So according to Chris Lamb, the white media really missed the story.
Michael, what about Jackie today? The book is 42 today. How does Jackie fit into the world in today's world?
Yeah, let me just focus on the topic of police brutality alone, if I can. when Robinson was a kid in Pasadena, he got in trouble with the law several times, usually for minor incidents. And at one point, through no fault of his own, he saw a police officer approach him, and the officer stuck a gun in his ribs. Now, let's fast forward to Robinson in his late 40s and early 50s. He's entering the Apollo Theater in Harlem, and a police officer mistakes him for somebody else and jams a gun in Robinson's ribs again. Throughout his adult life, Robinson spoke out forcefully against police brutality. Indeed, in the late 1960s, he stood with the Black Panthers when they faced the problem of police brutality and said that they rightfully turned to violence when police officers didn't protect them. So there's a direct connection, Marty, between Robinson's protests of police brutality throughout his life and the protests of police brutality that are going on today. Whether the protesters today know it or not, they stand on the broad shoulders of Jackie Robinson. That holds true for those who are protesting for unrestricted voting rights for Black Americans. Robinson believed that the best path to civil rights for Black Americans is through the buck and through the ballot. He was a vocal advocate for both of those. So there's another straight line between Robinson's legacy and those clamoring for unrestricted voting rights for Black Americans today.
Boy, I like the way you said that, standing on his broad shoulders today. A very, very good image, Michael. Michael Long with us. He edited the book 42 Today. What about the conflict of the man, Jackie Robinson, that you described, and Richard Nixon, of all people? Jackie became a Republican in the early 60s.
You know, Marty, he was a registered independent, but he acted like a Republican. You're right about that. In 1960, Robinson left his job at Chock Full of Nuts in Manhattan to campaign full-time for Richard Nixon during the 1960 presidential election. He believed that Nixon was the far better candidate on civil rights. Nixon had traveled to Africa and spoken about civil rights. He had steered passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act through Congress. He had promised Robinson that he would move faster on civil rights than Eisenhower ever had. And Robinson also met Kennedy, by the way, in Georgetown, in the Georgetown home. And he said that he told Rachel right after this meeting that Kennedy had never once looked him in the eye. And that meant a lot to Robinson. He also said that Kennedy had told him that he wasn't too familiar with Black issues. And so Robinson backed Nixon in 1960. Later, he did it with some regret. He turned on Nixon when he believed that Nixon was leading the white backlash to the civil rights movement in the country. And when he turned hard against Nixon.
You know, some people, one of the essays, George Vesey, of course, a wonderful writer, one of his essays talks about Jackie as a base runner and being in the ballpark, and George was there, and one of the Mets blundered, as they did in those days, and they got a discussion going of, well, Jackie never would have done that. Some people think that Jackie invented baseball, that when he got there in 1947, that he invented the game of baseball the way it was played. And I take exception with that, because the Negro Leagues were organized by Rube Foster back in 1920, and he learned to play baseball that way, and he brought Black baseball to the white major leagues, but he brought the baseball that he was taught how to play, that Monty Irvin learned how to play, that Oscar Charleston played. That's who Jackie was. It's just that the white America had never seen it against white players.
I could not agree with you more than I am, Marty. You're exactly right. When Vesey saw Robinson take that wide turn at first base and dance between the bases, and when he saw him do the hard slide, and when he saw him steal home plate, Vesey was catching a glimpse of the Negro League type of play. And Rachel, when she first saw that, she thought to herself, oh, yeah, Jackie's bringing the Negro Leagues into Major League Baseball. That's exactly what Robinson did. He transformed not only the complexion of the rosters, he transformed the game in many ways. Though I hasten to add here that we have to remember, too, that Ty Cobb stole home plate, I think, more than 40 times. So Robinson also echoed Ty Cobb's brilliant play from many, many years earlier.
What did you learn about the book, about Jackie, that maybe you didn't know before you put this wonderful book together?
You know, I first came to Robinson primarily through his civil rights and politics. believe it or not. I was studying Nixon at the time, and an archivist showed me this thick correspondence of letters between Robinson and Nixon. And that's how I really got captivated into Robinson and his legacy. So when I learn new things, it's usually about his baseball years. And Jonathan Ike has taught me a lot, and he taught me that story about number 42, which I really treasure. And I really love George Vesey's essay where he taught me about Robinson injecting Negro League play into Major League Baseball as well. So when I usually learn new things, it's about Robinson. I do want to emphasize that while he compiled Hall of Fame statistics, as we both know really well. But, you know, I want to emphasize that he did this under intense pressure. It is one thing to compile Hall of Fame statistics. It's another thing to do that while you're thinking that somebody's in the stands with a gun. You know, he got lots of death threats throughout his life. He faced racism throughout his career, not just in 47. So when I look at those Hall of Fame statistics, I'm amazed not only because they stand in and of themselves, but especially when I consider the context in which he compiled those statistics. So that was pretty new to me, too.
Boy, what a unique man, Jackie Robinson. It's great to talk to you this morning about it. What a unique man in history, in the history of our country, in the history of the world. And you just hit the nail right on the head on that. Not only a Hall of Fame player, but a Hall of Fame person with all the challenges. Boy, the book is terrific. The essays are terrific. And it's a pleasure to talk with you. Michael, what's the easiest way to get the book? We have our lovely independent bookstore, The Book Tree, up in Montclair. David, I'm sure, will have it. But what's the easiest way to order it?
Hey, go to The Book Tree. Go to The Book Tree's website. Go to all indie sites. You can find the book anywhere online. You can also find it at brick-and-mortar stores across the country.
Well, it's great to have you on. It's a pleasure, and you did a good job of putting this together. How hard was it to get all these people together, to get all these essays?
You know, I've edited books before, Marty, and it's usually like trying to herd cats. Really,
I was going
to
say that. I swear I was going to say the same thing.
But for this book, I'll tell you what, Robinson has such magnetic pull and magnetic power even today that when I reached out to these guys and women, they responded with a yes and a big yes right away, and they were really easy to work with. It was a labor of love and sheer pleasure.
Beautiful. Michael, thanks for being on. Michael Long, the book is 42 today. Great having you on. Be well, and I'd love to have you on again. We'll catch up with you. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Marty.
All right, more coming up. You're listening to KMBR 104.5 and 680, The Sports Leader.